Hey, Byzants, the time has come. On the air since 2009, the independently produced, non-FCC compliant champ of video game talk podcasting. Here comes Tiger Claw Radio. Here's your host, Critical Failure.
Welcome, everybody, to Tiger Claw Radio. I'm your host, Critical Failure, and we are back again. Seems like a special occasion. It feels good being back on the air, man. So, just yesterday, I was out in the car driving around just a wee bit, and I recorded some good old-fashioned van casting, and it felt good, man. It really did. Got a lot of stuff to talk about, but first, let's listen to some chiptunes. Now, I haven't really had my ear to the ground in the chiptune world too much, but I did hear that our good buddy Hemrock is still working through going through the old 8-Bit Collective archive, putting together his best of. And just yesterday, over on the Discord, he shot me a few picks that we could use for an episode. So, big thanks to Hemrock for making this possible. Let's listen to some of his chiptunes. And when we come back, we'll go to the van. You're listening to Tiger Claw Radio. Stick with us. That is Sarah with Close Encounter, and I wanted to lead off with that track. Hang on a second. Oh, thank goodness we're going to be doing van casting, so the mic issues aren't too much of a problem. I wanted to lead off with that track because Hemrock made the comment yesterday that discovering Sarah as an artist has been the thing that has made his trek through those old archives 100% worth it. And I got to say, good stuff, good stuff. So if you are interested in digging up... let's see if we can clean that up a little bit. Is that any better? It is. So if you're interested in digging up chiptunes history past, Serer is a good place to start. And those tracks are available on the 8-Bit Collective archive, which you can get off of archive.org. And there's also a torrent that's swirling around, a torrent that's legal. It's not, you know, there's no piracy. Every single song on the entire website was... not public domain, but Creative Commons. So it's a huge pile of MP3s, and then every MP3 also comes with a text file, which gives attribution to the artist. Good stuff. Good stuff. And it is a nice piece of preservation in an age when preservation is sorely needed in some cases. But with that, it's ramble time. So buckle up, boys and girls. Let's go to the van. You're listening to Tiger Claw Radio. Welcome, everybody. It's time for the van cast. I haven't done one of these in a while. I'm actually driving into the office for some unexpected business, and it is 10:17 a.m., nice and late, and it's rainy outside. Not pouring, not rain cats and dogs, but we have, like, a little mist. It's foggy out. You know, I got the windshield wipers on their low setting. You know, it'll be a nice leisurely drive. I'm headed out there after the morning rush has come and gone. Most of the people who are going to work have already gotten there, so I should be able to take the main road
instead of having to take the back roads to avoid traffic and whatnot. All right, so let's talk about video games. So it's been a little while since I did a TCR. What have I been up to? Well, the actual games I've been playing, because that's typically how you start these things, right? And then, who are you even playing? Zombie Army Trilogy has been my favorite. Is it a good game? I can't really say it's a good game, but I really enjoy it. It's themed very, very well. I never played Sniper Elite 2, so I think I will enjoy it more than most, because I've read that they use some of the same levels from Sniper Elite 2, just redone to look more like Halloween-ish and zombie-ish. Yeah, so as far as I'm concerned, it's a fun little zombie shooting game. And I've really been enjoying that. Swingle and I have been playing through it slowly over the months, but my internet kind of crapped out. It hasn't been working very well, so I just decided to play through it myself solo, and that's been taking time. You know, it's definitely a co-op game, and I'm typically partnered with Swingle, who's way better than me at these like shooting games, like way better. So, but it's been, it's, you know, it's a good game. It's really good. So there's that. That's all I can really say about that. It's a game that's been around a long time. Its regular price is like $45, but it goes on sale at like $15 during the major sales. Yeah, so I like that one. So, apart from that, in my free time, I've had this bug where I've been interested in development. And, I played the Pico 8 a good bit, and I started working on some Pico 8 games, or Pico 8 programs, rather, just to learn, you know, development with raw code, with Lua code. And, that's been slow going, but I've really been enjoying it because I have this cheesy little laptop that I got like a year ago or so, however long ago it was. And spec-wise, not a great machine. It really isn't. But there's a couple of things that it can do that, you know, I think is worth having it for, right? It's not a gaming machine by any stretch, but it can run some Pico 8. So I have me a tiny little Lua development kit, and I made some tabletop role-playing tools with it. You know, not anything, if you're listening to this show, it's probably not anything you'd be interested in that you would like, but where it captures my imagination is while I was making this thing, learning how to make this thing, thinking about, oh yeah, this technique here to move this data around, I could use this other way. And at first, I started laying in the groundwork. I was like, all right, I want to make a game for the Pico 8 that's like a strategy game with almost like, not like Civilization, but I had been playing a lot of like Nobunaga's Ambition and Romance of the Three Kingdoms and that sort of thing. I wanted to make something like that on a very small scale. But instead of like 50 different territories, it would just be four. You know? And what stopped me was, like, the Pico 8 has a limit on it where it can only house, like, I think it's, like, 8,100 tokens. A token being, like, an entity in code. So if you say, like, X equals 3, that's 3 tokens. One for the X, one for the equals, one for the 3. And to put it in perspective, my little RPG toolkit, which is super, super simple, is like 2,000 tokens. So that's like a quarter of the amount that you can put into a Pico 8 game. Long story short, I realized that I knew how to make something really cool, but Pico 8 wasn't going to let me do it. So I started looking at other micro consoles, just because, not even that I was interested in like making a micro console game at this point, it's just that I like the fact that all of the tools are packaged together in one thing, right? You got your sprite editor, it's right there. You got a waveform editor to make sound effects. You got a tracker to make music. You got a map editor that's integrated. And on top of that, when you're actually doing the raw programming, there's a bunch of, there's a library of functions that are written in that you don't have to write. Like, for example, when you draw the map, right, there's functions that read the map in. So I can kind of skip having to learn how that works. So, yeah. So, development has been interesting. Hang on a second. Am I going to go this way? No, we'll just go straight. I worked on... It was a while ago, but this was after the last TCR. I worked on my RPG Maker 2003 game a little bit. Because that was like, hey, I'm going to make the simplest game in the world. I kind of left it alone. Hadn't messed with it in a while. So I opened it up and started working with it again. And it, the big thing with that game is the mechanical balance. So it's not necessarily to do anything to do with coding in events or drawing sprites or any of that stuff. The stuff that you would typically think of as difficult when you're making a game. No, it's not any of that. It's that it's getting the level and stat economy working. Because I very much wanted it to be like you're starting doing like 2 or 3 damage when you swing and you've got like maybe 10 hit points or something like that. And you can do like 2 or 3 battles tops. And then you got to run back and heal up. I wanted it to be like an old school Western game where you're... I guess not even Western, because JRPGs are like this, or were at one point. I wanted there to be a grind. The grind is the game. That's the way RPGs used to be, like a long time ago. And if I was making a thin, basic story, then I think those would complement each other well. And that has proven to be an undertaking. I'm proud of what I made so far, but, you know, that's... I don't want to say it's difficult, but there's a lot of moving parts involved, right? I think anybody who can get a couple of maps and a couple encounters together in RPG Maker could do this. I don't think there's anything I don't think there's any technical bar of entry, you know, like there is with, say, Pico 8. But yeah. So that has been fun, and then I also made this mechanic where, I had this idea like a long time ago where you've got a stat in the background that you don't see, but it's there, of your popularity, okay? The Morrowind has the same thing, but it's front and center. You can see it in the menu. It's like your reputation or something. And as your reputation climbs, certain doors are open to you. And I have the reputation stat, and when you complete a quest, that reputation stat goes up by 1. I wasn't sure what to do with it. Like, I made a pub map, and if you try and enter the back room, the bartender's like, no, don't go back there. But if your reputation's high enough, then he'll let you. That kind of thing. But then I thought, okay, wait, hang on. What is it that Western RPGs had that's different from JRPGs of the time, okay? At least when it comes to old PC grinders that I like, right? The dirt scum RPGs. You know what I'm talking about. The Might and Magics, the Wizardries. The characters in those games, they weren't really part of the story, per se. They were just the heroes. And you named them whatever you wanted to name them. And they took their place in the party, and that was it. Okay, so the downside is... It's very difficult to involve characters like that in a story, but the upside is that the player has a lot more control over what they want their party to be, and there's more variation when you're actually playing through the game. So this is what I came up with. By default, RPG Maker 2003 gives you access to, I think it's 14 or 15 character slots. You can raise it up as high as you want, but a lot. So I made an event where there's like a guild, and you go talk to the guild guy, and he will assign a random person to your party. Okay, this took a long time to figure out, by the way. He'll choose one of the 14 people randomly and put him in your party, and it's different every time you play. And the way I'm going to do it is, right out of the gate, you find the guild guy, you can talk to him and get one extra party member. But then, as your reputation increases, you can go back to the guild guy and fill out your party that way. With, you know, obviously with a max of 4 members in the party. I think that's kind of a neat idea. The thing is, right now, the party's being generated entirely by random. So you could have, you know, the guy you use by default is your typical fighter character, but you could have a party of one fighter and 3 healers at this point. So I don't know. Again, we're talking about an RPG Maker 2003 game that was supposed to be a throwaway game made with pre-made graphics. So I can feel this being like scope creep, like I'm overthinking it. But I thought that was a fun mechanic in a game that was otherwise, you know, cookie cutter. Also, on the subject of RPG Maker, I recently discovered something. Now, I mentioned this before, but I didn't realize exactly what it was. Easy RPG, right? Have I talked about that? I'm sure I have. I've used it in I've talked about it in a couple recordings, but I think those recordings ended up getting scrapped. But basically, here's the deal. Whoever's developing this project, they're making this free development tool that makes games compatible with RPG Maker 2K and RPG Maker 2K3. And they're doing it by making a runtime package that, it's basically like Free Doom. You remember Free Doom? They rebuilt Doom from the ground up using non-proprietary graphics and sound and maps so that you could play something like Doom with the same engine, just, you know, different. Well, that's what they're doing with RPG Maker 2000 and 2003. And as far as PC is concerned, it's not such a big deal because you can, you know, RPG Maker 2000 is routinely $2, whatever. But it is a big deal because it runs on emulation handhelds like the Ambernic. And it's compatible with your RPG Maker 2 and 2K3 games. So that means this 2K3 game that I'm working on, with a cookie cutter story and a funny little mechanic where your party is different every time you play, supposedly, at some point in the near future, that is going to be playable on the Ambernic devices. Now, on my Ambernic device, I got the Easy RPG OPK, so that already exists. And supposedly I can feed it games to make it run somehow, but I haven't actually tried it yet because I've been busy with other things. I think that is super-duper cool. So I checked out the website, and they don't have a stable release of the program out yet, but you can get the Easy RPG editor. And the way it works is, it's a lot like a Doom mapper. You install it and it can edit RPG games, but it doesn't have any graphics. You got to point it to the official RPG Maker 2K runtime package. So I'm not sure. Here's the thing. When it comes to these RPG Maker games, I know that you can import like JPEGs or whatever, PNG files, and you can, you know, do your own graphics that way. What I'm not sure of is this. Can you make a standalone runtime package of entirely non-proprietary graphics? Because if you can do that, well, then you got this tool and it's free and you can make it and there you go. And we can have all the JRPG silliness you could ever imagine. I don't know, even as I'm describing this whole situation, I don't know why it got me excited, because the reality is, there's nothing I'm going to do with a free version of RPG Maker 2000 or 2003. Personally, no. I might open it up, see what it looks like. You know, I might make a screen or two of a meme game that'll never see the light of day. I'm not going to make a project with it. I think it matters because we're talking about tools being available to more people. Okay, and not just because, hey, I don't want to pay for RPG Maker 2000. Now here's a way I can do it legally. Although that is the thing. It's that they're making it available on more platforms. So this is going to be like a Linux thing. It's going to be a Chromebook thing. It's going to be, on more platforms than just the PC, which I think is great. It's going to be on Raspberry Pi, which I think is awesome. Yeah. So that's that. I'm actually getting on the highway now. And I forgot that when I used to do these van casts, I would always sign off before I got on the highway. And I forgot why. And the reason why is because here I am in the rain, getting ready to merge onto the highway. And I'm not seasoned with highway driving anymore, because I've been teleworking for a couple of years now. And when I first started working downtown, driving on the highway scared the bejesus out of me. Because people would go 1 inch off of your bumper at 60 miles an hour. And it's like, hey man, I get it that you have to get to work, but I'm not trying to die out here. People die out here all the time and it doesn't even make the paper, you know? Doesn't even make the evening news. Some ding dong ran into some other ding dong on the highway and they both flipped over. Well. Looks like I have merced onto the highway fairly safely. There's a few people out. The highway definitely isn't dead, but it's not bumper to bumper either, so I guess we're in good shape. How are we doing on time? 17 minutes? Wow, this is an entire show, boys. I wasn't even done. What was I talking about? Oh, right. I went on that big tangent about development and all that stuff. And, I don't know. I just enjoy it. I enjoy development. None of these projects might ever see the light of day, but I still think it's worth it. I still think it's a good time because I'm learning as I'm playing. Do you know what I mean? I had a talk with Dorobka yesterday, which was awesome because I haven't, been talking to the boys much. And he was talking about doing some programs in Unity. And I was like, man, I'm on board. Because Dorobka is not like a programming guy. He doesn't really want to do the development. He's an art guy. So I've always, if he and I could put our brains together in a single project, I think we can make really good things, right? He and I worked together on like a monster manual for a tabletop role-playing game, OSR, right? It's Old School Revival, basically like non-proprietary versions of the original Dungeons & Dragons. Well, we started working on a monster manual together where I was doing... Whoa, my goodness! Give me a second. Hang on a second. Safety issues out here on the road. I think we're good. Yeah, I was doing all the writing and he was doing all the artwork. And the stats, I didn't even worry about. We used a random generator to make 100 monsters. And there you go. And the prototype, honestly, in my opinion, the prototype is amazing. I only hired him to do 11 drawings, so it's not like a monster manual where every monster gets a drawing. But I think, and Sean, I think you'd agree with me, the prototype, even though it's not done yet, that's some good stuff. Like, and we've played with some of those monsters in playtesting and stuff. I'm proud of that. So there you go, perfect match. I was doing the writing, I was wrestling with LibreOffice to make the PDF, and he was doing his artwork thing. And that's a good example of Sean and I working together in the best way possible. Alright, so I'm going to jump tap topics at like breakneck speed. You ready? Well, I like old things, and I like old computer games. So... I had the thought that crosses my mind. This is not a new thought. I think about this like once every couple of years or so. Hang on a second. I'm changing lanes in the rain on the highway, and it's a little dangerous. And there we go. Okay, we're good. We're good. Right, so I like text adventures. Old, late 70s, early 80s text adventures. Infocom. If you're not familiar with the company Infocom, they made text adventures in the late 70s and early 80s. And It was a different time for video games. They were text adventures, but, you know, they came in these packages that were would put any deluxe edition of anything to shame, right? Get on Google Image Search and look up Infocom box art. Just look at what their games look like. And they come in these huge packages with, like, maps and trinkets and other things. Text adventures, text, right? That's part of early PC gaming, a huge part. So I was thinking about that, and I remembered, oh, yeah, there's an MMO version of that, multi-user dungeons, MUDs, they're called. And I used to play MUDs back in probably 2004 or so. At the time, we had dial-up internet at my house because I was working with a plumber at the time. I was a plumber's helper, and my wife worked in retail. And we didn't have a real use. We didn't have a, well, not a use, but I would say we didn't have a pressing need to have internet in the house. Because I worked manual labor, we didn't have, like, streaming services then. Back then, if you had Netflix, Netflix would still send you DVDs in the mail. So, like, that kind of stuff, we would just buy VHS tapes for $1, watch them, and then get rid of them or whatever. So I did have a computer that I got from somebody, but I would play a lot of ZZT and DOSBox, and I played MUDs on dial-up internet. So I revisited them, because they're still around, and I downloaded an interpreter on my janky old laptop, or not old, but my janky budget laptop, and I started playing a game called Zombie MUD, which is, you know, it launched in 1994 and is still around. And it's like, yeah, man, I was playing it last night, and what makes it different from, okay, first of all, it is multi-user, but it's essentially a single-player experience at this point, right? Because you have this huge world, and there's 30 people playing in it, and that's a very populated world, right? Imagine playing World of Warcraft, and there's 30 people in the entire world. You'll never see anyone. Right, they're there, but you'll never see them because they're in different parts of the world. That's essentially how it is. But what I like about it is that it's an old school text adventure, you know, like Zork or something, with basic RPG mechanics. Right, you know, you didn't have hit points in Zork. I don't think you didn't have, you know, learn spells or whatever. You didn't have stats, any of that stuff. You just went and you got the treasure, and that was it. So there's that, and I enjoyed it. I was like, this is really awesome. And I started thinking, they put so much effort in games today on the front end, right? They make the graphics look great, and they work on making things look shiny and stuff. And that's awesome, right? I'm not anti-graphics anymore, because Skyrim's a good-looking game, right? I get it, the Daggerfall had the bigger world, but Skyrim's still a good-looking game. But here's the thing. Where's all the development under the hood? Where is all the... I would love to see a game that looks, like, okay, or whatever. You know? Maybe sprite-based, maybe text-based, whatever. But, you know, the exploration area is the size of planet Earth. Or something like that. Something that, like, two or three guys could develop visually, but then you get a big AAA team developing under the hood. And that's kind of what MUDs feel like. Because the old ones that have been around for 20 plus years, 30 years, whatever, they've been continually developing, right? And they have, it's like a text adventure, but instead of, I think it's like 20, 30 rooms, whatever Zork has, it's more like 1,000 or something. I don't know. It just seemed cool. I don't think I would ever develop a text adventure myself. I wanted to for a while. There's a program called Inform 7 that you can use to make a modern text adventure. Except the text adventures these days, you don't make standalone programs to do it. All right. Text adventures, first of all, now they're called interactive fiction. instead of text adventures. And if you're going to make one, you get like an INI file. That's what the result is. And then if someone's going to play it, they have to load it into an interpreter. And it's an extra step, but the reason is you can put an interpreter on everything. You know, a phone can have one. you can put one on your Raspberry Pi. You can put one on, you know, whatever. So they're separated from like regular video game people, I think. But I don't know. I kind of got in this old like Infocom headspace. I think I was in the right spirit for it. You know, messing with Pico 8 and Pico 8 and tabletop role playing games and stuff like that. So yeah, that was my evening last night. I played Zombie Mud for probably about 2 hours, and it's a commitment getting into one of those games, man. It really is, because you got to learn the language, you know. You got to learn the language, and I was lucky enough that the one that I wandered into had like a mini map in some areas. And when I say mini map, I mean an ASCII graphic map that's probably 10 characters by 10 characters, just so you can see what's north, south, east, and west. That's it. There are some that don't have that, and I find that difficult to get around in, because you're kind of expected to draw a paper map or whatever. But yeah, I don't know. If you've never done a text adventure, you should try one. I'm not going to say you should try MUDs, because MUDs are a dumpster fire, right? I thankfully found one that was like a regular game, but there's a lot of like degeneracy in MUDs and stuff like that. So user beware if you did, you know, go down that route. But man, if you never played an Infocom game, if you've never played the OG Zork, come on. Come on, man. It's good. I promise you it's good. You know, you got to use your imagination a little bit. It's definitely the book version and not the movie version, but there is something to that game, I think. Tangent over, I guess. Wow, I'm downtown again. I haven't been down here in a while. The rain was kind of spooky. I was out on the highway and it was like, the trucks were spitting and stuff and visibility was low and didn't look like it was raining that hard until I got on the highway, and then I was like, oh dear. All right. Let's see how the neighborhood's changed. All right, so here's the thing. I have got to go into the office, which is now just down the street, and I've got to do my thing, and then I'm going to drive home. So I'm going to jump off of here, and I'll either see you back in the studio or see you on the drive home. Not sure at this point.
Back again in the studio, and I did record an additional bit, but before we get to that, we're going to return to Hemrock's Chiptunes. But before that even, usually at about the 20-minute mark, I like to thank the sponsors, and even though Patreon has shut down, I still want to thank everyone who's not only donated a dime or a penny to the name of TCR, but those of you who donate your time as well, because let's face it, the more I get old, the more I realize that time is, in fact, the most valuable currency. So I appreciate what you spend hanging out here. and I just want to take a moment to say thanks. With that said, let's go back to the chiptunes and see what we got.
Your hand. And we are so close.
That's the brightest stars. You know, I usually check out as soon as lyrics kick in when it comes to chiptunes. But that one is okay. I dig that one. It has a very ending credits vibe to it. Also, I gotta say, when it comes to chiptunes, my favorite ones are the ones that are upbeat and really positive feeling. I think that's something that chiptunes do very, very well. That said, thanks for listening. Let's go back to the van one more time on Tiger Claw Radio.
All right. We're back on the road. So I've been teleworking since the beginning of the pandemic, which has been over 2 years now. Back at the office, I've had this... People usually think of cubicles as like a dreary place, like a place dreams go to die. I loved my cubicle, man. I had a corner window cubicle on the 9th floor. It was bigger than everybody else's because of that. And I would go in. I had the early shift, so I would start at 7:30, but I'd get there at 7. And I'd sit at a little like TV tray that I always had next to the window. And I would sit at that TV tray and look out over the city from this 9th floor window seat. And that's how I ate breakfast every morning. Well, since we have been teleworking so long, they sent me in to clear out my cube, which makes perfect sense because there's people still working in that building. So I have to assume they're going to like reassign it or something or do something with it that makes economic sense. But... You know, on a personal level, I loved that cube, man. I had some crappy cubes before that. And when I got to that one, I was like, look, this is where I want to stay. Please don't move me. And there were a couple of times where they shuffled people around and they're like, all right, we're going to leave. We're going to leave you where you are because we know you like it. I was like, yes, thank you. Good looking out. Appreciate that. You know? And yeah, I just cleaned it out. I got two boxes full of stuff and, you know, mostly stuff that I haven't had the chance to mess with in a couple of years. Hang on a second. I'm making a left, but people are wandering into the street, which is fine. But I just got to nose out so I don't miss the light. All right. Hang tight 1 second. And yeah, there we go. Now we're safe. So now it's back home again. Yeah. So it's been weird also doing this drive because this is the drive that kept TCR alive for quite some time. Never any time to do anything at home, you know, because of children, you know, and responsibilities and whatnot. Never any time to record at work because you're at work. Even if it's slow time, I can't pull out my phone in the middle of the office and be like, hey, video games, right? No. So this drive was really the only place to do TCR for a long time. And I think when the pandemic started and I started working from home, I think that was like the beginning of the end. Like we went strong for at least a year, year and a half, but I just needed time that I didn't have. So it's cool to be out here on the road again in the morning, to be perfectly honest with you. I like being home, but part of me thinks, you know, like working back at the office again would be good. I really, you know, kind of miss having my own space out there. And to bring things back to video games, one of the things that I was doing when the pandemic started, because I thought, I don't know, we all thought this was only going to last like a couple weeks, right? 2 weeks to flatten the curve, and that what they were saying in the beginning. I ordered a bunch of PlayStation games from Japan. Somebody had pennied out a bunch of them, you know, a bunch, and I put a couple dollars down on every game I could see. Ended up with a nice, tasty lot. Now, you know, that was the beginning of the pandemic, so of course it took a long time for that stuff to show up on my doorstep. But importing was like a thing that I enjoyed after that. That was the start of me really like getting into, you know, importing PlayStation games, which is something I enjoy very much. I run them on an emulator on my PC, you know, put the disc in the drive because I built my tower to have a CD drive, and I'll rip them and I put some of them on my AmberNIC, and it's a good time. It's a good time. And so bringing things back to modern day, I was cruising around on eBay. Same thing happened again. A very large amount of PS. Well, I say very large, probably like 10, 15 games. We're all getting pennied out. And so I did the same thing again. And I was like, all right, $5, $3, whatever it is, a game. And some ones that I really wanted, I didn't get. Like, one of them was Tenchu Stealth Assassins, the first one. And I've got the second one, you know, imported. So I thought it'd be cool to have the first one. So I missed out on that. That kind of sucks. What else did I miss out on? All of the Crash Bandicoot games, like all of them, went. And I have Crash Bandicoot 2, you know, the American Crash Bandicoot 2 for PlayStation. So I wanted 1 and 3, and they both got away. Those are actual quality games that people wanted. Final Fantasies always show up when there's a lot like this. Final Fantasy 7 and 9 were both there, and they ended up closing at like $6 or something like that. Parasite Eve was there as well, and that would have been kind of cool to have. I had the American Parasite Eve until I sold my games in 2008, I guess it was 2007, 2008, something like that. I wonder if that was like the last really good PS1 game that I got in that era. Was when my older brother got me a copy of Parasite Eve for my birthday. but what I actually ended up with, what did I end up with? I know I got like a weird dieting game, which is like, it's not going to be good, but oh, you Japanese, I can't wait to see it. It's like Happy Food or Happy Diet or something like that. Oh, it's crazy. So I got that. I got like a breakout game. I got Gran Turismo 1 and 2, which will be interesting. I had Gran Turismo 1 imported, and I put it in the, I'm pretty sure I put it in one of the, like, the retro junk boxes. So I'll be able to get that back. And GT2, good game. Don't care what anybody says. So that'll be fun. I seem to remember there being more of, like, a big ticket game. And I can't think off the top of my head what it is. Like, there was at least one game in that lot that I was like, I'm really looking forward to getting this one particular game. But now it's escaping me. Because I really wanted to get Tenchu Stealth Assassins, and I didn't. And that was a disappointment. Whoa! That was hydroplaning. Man, oh man. We're getting back on the highway again. Alright, here we go. You know what? I think I might pause this for the time being. I remember what it was now. It was one of those Koei strategy games. Because I was on that big Koei strategy game kick, playing a lot of Nobunaga's Ambition, and a Romance of the Three Kingdoms and whatnot. It was one of the PS1 Nobunaga's Ambition games, which is going to get played approximately, you know, 10 minutes and then go on the shelf. But I got it. It's going to come in the mail, and it was like $3 or something like that, which is kind of fun. Probably the best import that I got is Bomberman World for PS1. That was in my last batch of games that I got, you know, several months back. I sat down and played it recently, and that's a game that plays perfectly. Enough of the menus are in English, and it's not a story-based game whatsoever. You can just play and have a good time, and it is awesome. That is a game that I would recommend if you find it on the cheapskies. Because I can't remember what I paid for it, but it was not a lot. It was less than $10. I'm usually not paying $10 for a Japanese import PS1 game. I don't think $10 is too much for a game, but if it's going to be $10, it's got to be a game that I can understand, a game that I intend to sit down and play, something that I'm going to put time into. Bomberman World is a game that, you know, is that good, I think. Oh yeah, another one that turned up was Resident Evil 2. Resident Evil 2 shows up a lot in these import PS2 games when they're getting dumped. Of course, I bid on that on a couple of different places, and they're not huge expensive, but they don't go for pennies either. That was one that was like, I don't know, $12 or $13 or something like that. So, there you go. Oh, right. Yes, there was another one. Rage Racer was being sold as well. The Japanese import version of Rage Racer. Love that game, man. pretty sure I even have the English version, but one of the past, you know, instances of buying imports, I got Ridge Racer, the original Ridge Racer for PS1, Japanese import game. Now, the original was before they didn't have the whole, you know, earn credits, buy better cars. That wasn't a thing yet. So very playable. That ended up being one of the most played of these import games that I got was Ridge Racer. Really wanted to get Ridge Racer, right? That was a game I played a ton in English. I would know it well enough that I could play it even if I couldn't read it. That slipped away. And it sucks because it slipped away at a price I would have paid, too. Like, I forget that this happens, you know, that people wait till the end and snipe auctions. But I think that one went for $4. I probably would have went as high as, like, 6 or 7 or something for that. Hang on a second. Time to escape the highway to safer pastures. So that was kind of I guess it was a little bit of a drag, but I ended up spending a bunch of money anyway. So it was like $37, I think, when all is said and done. For all the import games I did end up with. And yes, I ended up with a bunch of trash import games. That's always the outcome when I do this. But, you know, whatever. It's fun. It's a good time, right? And that's really the point of it all, isn't it? The imports have kept me grounded in the console world just a little bit. Because of all the stuff I do with PCs and whatnot. It's nice to have one foot in the old world of controllers and physical media and whatnot. Well, that about wraps it up, I think, for this edition of the VanCast. Thanks for everybody who's still listening after all this time. And I'll see you guys back in the studio.
Back again in the studio, and here we are, nearing the 50-minute mark. And something happened just since yesterday when I recorded that, and that's Pico 8, which I've been talking about. It's been something I've very much enjoyed. It actually has a free version out now, which it never has. It's been $15 for, you know, several years. I've heard people complain, how come it's not free? How come it's not free? There are free game players where you can just play the cards but not actually make something. Well, Lexilawful made a free... They made an education version. So this is not a ripped-off pirate jag, as it were. This is actually... They got behind it and made this happen themselves, and I couldn't be prouder of them. It's great. Now, it plays off of a website, and it does not have the Splore function, so you're not going to be able to, like, cruise all of the, you know, cruise the storefront, so to speak. But you can save and load cartridges. You can download them to your, you know, PC and then load them into this thing and play them, and It's super cool. I love it. But most importantly, so you can make chiptunes in Pico 8. And a while back, I asked over on Battle of the Bits. Oops, sorry. I asked on Battle of the Bits, hey, what do you think about Pico 8? Is this a format? And they didn't like it because it cost you had to pay to get in. And then there was, at the same time, there was Tick 80, which was free and still is free. So Tick 80 was a format on Battle of the Bits, but not Pico 8. And I'm hoping that now that they offer this entertainment version, or not entertainment, education version, excuse me, Freudian slip there, that maybe it will be another way to make chiptunes on Battle of the Bits. Actually, you know what? Let's see, because I posted a topic over on Battle of the Bits asking them what they thought. Years ago, someone tried to fork Tico 80 into a Pico 8 Libre clone. I didn't try it out yet. Fupe 8. Yeah, they kind of buried the lead on that one. I asked him, since this is an official education version of Pico 8, which allows for saving, since Pico 8 can now be used for free, would that make it a potential official chiptune format? And someone talked about a fork, but they didn't really say yes or no. It's got a bunch of thumbs up, but that's about it. This was posted, I don't know, the time zones are weird. I posted this today, like several hours ago, so it's been up most of the day. I don't know. We'll see next episode. We'll see what they do. You know, I have a touch-and-go history with Battle of the Bits. I don't agree with everything they do over there, but the reality is there's some brilliant artists on that website, and I would like to see all the doors open as possible. So, I don't know. We'll see what happens. All right. So let's move on from Pico 8. Give me a second. Yeah. All right. I had to take a quick break there. So I don't have a traditional fail bag in that sense. I think the last episode of TCR, it's been a couple weeks. So I will check in to see if there's any anything on the YouTube page. I know we had a conversation on the Discord last night in the fail bag section, and Hemrock was asking about Final Fantasy games, and we had a good conversation about the order of operations in terms of favorite Final Fantasy games. Give me a second here. Let's stop by YouTube real quick. Yeah, okay, here we go. Now you'll have to forgive me because I'm looking at the YouTube front end, and YouTube has a habit of being really shady when it comes to comments. So we got one from Desm that says, I have a repro for Splatterhouse 3 with with a box, and it looks great. Looks really great. I keep a sticker on it to indicate it's a repro. I also have an original Grindstormer card, but the board is fried. Crappy tension card. And I'm planning to use as a donor card from Mickey's Ultimate Challenge to transplant the ROM into. Yeah, man, I have got to say, I'm all about those repro cards. I know, I like the way you did it, where it's like, you have a sticker, you're not trying to pull anything over on anybody. Like, it's clear that it's a repro, but you wanted to have it in the box. I think that's perfectly fine. I'm right there with you. Mecha Menace, what's on my shelf, says, I'm not completely versed, this is a long one. I'm not completely versed on the special features of every Game Boy game when used to the Super Game Boy. Back in the day, I thought all it does was change the tone of the graphics and fill the sides in with a pretty border. Yeah, me too. Now that I'm a little more versed, I'm shocked why Nintendo didn't make it more apparent that some games had features like adding multiplayer without a second cart, adding a richer color palette, or upgrading sound. Maybe it was because features varied from game to game, and they couldn't sell the thing, unknowing what devs would add. I thought it wasn't until the GBA that some games supported limited one-card multiplayer. Super Game Boy actually did this earlier, sure, but some games have Big Brother counterparts. But if you came over to the SGB Enhanced Friends place with a Game Boy card that supported this feature, you'd definitely try it. Hey, maybe your friend didn't have Madden 96 or Killer Instinct on Super Nintendo. Wario Blast is another. That game is basically Bomberman mixed with Wario. Guess what? 4-player support. I guess it's using the multi-tap? I never tried. I read this in the manual. Everyone probably already knows that when you insert the black and white version of Space Invaders into the Super Game Boy, you get the SNES version. I didn't know that. I remember hearing about another game that opened up an entirely new game on the SNES, but that info wasn't retained. I also have read or heard Super Game Boy screws up some games. I think it only allows one save in Wario Land or Wario Land 2. Maybe not those games, but I remember something about it screwing up with a save file in some game. I'd like Super Game Boy info centralized. Understandably, there's a lot to cover. A Wikipedia page lists 1,048 licensed Game Boy games, domestic and foreign. Furthermore, the Game Boy Color card adds boot on all Game Boy. Jeez, man, it's so hard. Game Boy Color carts boot on Super Game Boy. That's an additional library to research. Actually, the Super Game Boy was released in 1994, so that cuts 5 years of games to test. However, there may be some games released earlier that were developed with hardware in mind, so maybe it would be 93 onward task? It would be cool if Super Game Boy features were listed on every Game Boy game, even if it was only a standard palette and border options, similar to those compatibility lists you see for emulators. It sounds like a huge community undertaking. The problem is sourcing every physical cart. I'm sure there are emulators which boot Game Boy games as if they're running on Super Game Boy, but does that take into account the SNES hardware? For instance, would you be able to know whether you could plug in controllers and play multiplayer? I don't know. I mean, you raised some good questions. I'm going to be honest. I didn't know that there was any of this involved in the Super Game Boy. I always thought it just like gave a pretty background, because you got to remember, in those days, the fact that it took your Game Boy game and put it on the television was a big deal, right? So put in the context of the time it came out, that basic feature was enough to justify the product. Now, later in life, I tried Pokemon on it. I think it was Pokemon. And I remember seeing, like, a special background just that was just for Pokemon. And at that point, I was like, whoa, cool, I didn't know it could do this. The stuff you're talking about in this comment, like it bringing up the Super Nintendo version of Space Invaders, I had no idea about any of that. That is banana. And I've had one of these things for years. I wish I had Space Invaders for Game Boy. I might track that down and see how much it costs. Yeah, but I guess it would take... That's the kind of thing that would take... it would take Super Game Boy enthusiasts. Not just video game enthusiasts. Not just Game Boy enthusiasts. Super Game Boy enthusiasts. And let's be brutally honest. There aren't too many of those. to answer your question about emulation, I'm no emulation expert, but there are emulators where you can boot up a Super Game Boy version of something, and I think they would do more or less a pretty good job of telling what you could or couldn't do, you know, but I don't know. I'm interested, but not enough to undertake a huge experiment. However, I am interested enough to plug in my old Super Game Boy, because my Super Nintendo is plugged in, mind you. Because I've been buying those imports, so it's been plugged in for a little while now. I've been playing it. And plug in the old Super Game Boy, get out my box of Game Boy games, because I have a nice big shoebox of Game Boy carts. You know, check them all out. See if there's any that, you know, maybe have any powers I wasn't aware of. I think that might be cool. All right. That said, let's shift gears and go back to the Discord. And we talked about... What are your top Final Fantasy games? Sean was talking about how he was playing Phantasy Star 2. And that's great. I had Phantasy Star 2 for a long time. Tried it a couple times. I couldn't grind hard enough to get anywhere in it. And then years of having it unplayed, I finally sold it in the culling of my collection when I was trying to pare down. I'm glad I did, because the person who bought it was a collector and not a reseller. And hopefully they'll have fun with it. And, you know, it's fine. It's fine. There are, you know, like with most things, there are ROM hacks out there that balance that a little bit. They'll do things like give you double experience to cut down on the grinding and things like that. So if I want to play Phantasy Star 2, that might be the way to go. Another good way to go would be to do the Android version if you want to play it vanilla, just because the Android version has cloud saving, so you could play it on your phone, then go home, and I could play it on my Android box, and that sort of thing. That's another good way to go. Like, if you don't want to do ROM hacks, I would suggest that. So, let's see. I didn't write out a list, but 9, when it comes to Final Fantasy, 9 is definitely my favorite. It was the one that I got when it was brand new, and I loved it, and yeah, I still have my original Final Fantasy 9 from the very beginning. It's one of the few PlayStation games that survived. Even after I sold all my games, I kept that one. Final Fantasy 9, see, then 7 is shortly after, just because 7 was one of those games that by itself changed the world. Then after that is Legends 3 on Game Boy, which is one that's purely nostalgia. My older brother had it. We played it. I loved it. I loved the time travel aspect of it, and it's a game that, despite being the old hardware, it's a believable story and a good game. And I know the whole thing about the Final Fantasy Legends games not being true Final Fantasy games. They're another franchise. They were ported over. They renamed as Final Fantasy. I don't care. It still fits. I love it. It's a good game. Tactics is really good, but I never really got traction in Tactics. My older brother did, but I didn't. And so after Legends 3, I would probably put the original Final Fantasy for NES. And after that, I think, every other Final Fantasy game on planet Earth is a tie. And that's my list. Let's see. I think Hemrock put his list in here. I know he's got a list. Yeah. Final Fantasy 2. Okay. From number 7 up to number 1, he says Final Fantasy 2 is his 7th best. Yeah, Black Sheep of the series, but I enjoyed it, and I still think it's a good game. Final Fantasy 4, this is the game that everyone else seems to like more than I do. It's a great game, don't get me wrong. But I didn't have the best battle. didn't have the best battle mechanics, and it's more story heavy, which I didn't get much into. You know, interestingly enough, I have the Tokyo Pop Final Fantasy IV soundtrack that I bought from GameStop back in the early 2000s. So 20 years I've had that. Original Final Fantasy, Final Fantasy 1. Yeah, I like this more than FF4. It's the only Final Fantasy game that I've completed more than once. I've actually gone through it 3 times. I prefer the PS1 remake over the NES version. The new OST on the PS1 is fantastic. One of the reasons I adore this gem is there are good hacks that enrich the experience and push me to play it all over again. Good pick, good pick. Number 4, Final Fantasy 3, job system, catchy chiptunes, pleasant pixels. I gotta say, I played the Final Fantasy 3 DS remake. I played it on the Ouya, and I really enjoyed it. Didn't beat it because, reasons, but I really enjoyed it. Final Fantasy 7, in addition to completing this game, I also watched one of my favorite LPers play this, and it's sentimental in that way. With that said, there's a lot of faults with this game, but whatever. And there's 2 left. Number 2... it's Final Fantasy VI. This one's very close to being number 1. Terra's favorite theme. Terra's theme is my favorite FF tune. And then his favorite number 1 is Final Fantasy V. The pixel art and music, only bested by FF6, but the amazing job system pushes it over the top. Granted, the story is not as involved with 6 or 7, but I'm okay with that. Plus, the OST is amazing, and I feel like it doesn't get enough credit. Wow, turned on to listen to it while I type this, and I'm getting goosebumps. Man, FF5 is the pinnacle. That's cool, man. That's a good list. That's a list from a guy who's played a heck of a lot more Final Fantasy than I have. And that's it. We're 1 hour and 5 minutes in, and I'm out of time, boys and girls. I don't have time to put the entry in because I have to go take care of my exit stuff. So thank you very much for listening to TCR. I don't know when the next episode is going to be out, but stick with us. Stay involved with the YouTube channel. Come down to the Discord if you haven't been there. Big thanks to Sendu over at Light Studios and It's Tale Time for keeping the show on his podcast network. Thanks very much. I'll see you in the next one.